Hey, Brian.
Hey, Elliot.
What's the talk of the table?
Today, we are sitting down with Jason Morningstar, co-owner, creative director, and lead designer of Bully Pulpit Games. You may know him from some of over his 100 published games, including beloved titles like Fiasco, Night Witches, Juggernaut, and so many more. He is currently crowdfunding his latest design, the Slavic fairy tale-inspired Zhenya's Wonder Tales. Jason? Welcome to the table.
Welcome. Thanks for having me, Brian. Thank you, Elliot. I'm so glad to be here.
We're so excited to have you.
I'll be honest, when we started the show, we made a big list of like, who are the guests we'd like to have on? And I think your name was within the first five people we thought of.
Gosh. You should have got in touch earlier. I would have been happy to come talk to you.
Took us long enough, right?
I know.
Right?
So, Jason, we wanted to have you on the show, one, because you've got a very interesting crowdfunding going on right now for Zhenya's Wonder Tales. But really, what we want to get into with you today is your career in game design, how you have made a career as a game designer, making over 100 published titles, and I'm sure at least another 100 unpublished titles in the mix there, how all of this has led to this most recent project. And along the way, we want to get into some stuff like taking a game from book to box with Fiasco on the design front, your influence in work in LARPs, and some of the kind of other ways you've made a career with commissioned work for various organizations. Now, that's all a lot. But from where I'm coming from, so I, for context, quit my job to be a game designer about a year ago. I just had my 1 year anniversary of full-time games. And in a lot of ways, I think you have a career that I aspire to, I am working towards. So a broad question to start, but hopefully a fun one. Is there a truth or belief you've had about game design that you think has held throughout this career that you've had?
Man, I don't know, because I'm constantly testing my own assumptions, right? A lot of my games, and frankly, some of my best games, come from challenging what the status quo is. So, like, The Skeletons is a game that I really love and that has been well received. And really, what I was thinking about in that game was the value of silence. Like, when we sit down to play, it's often a very busy experience. There's constant talk and crosstalk. And you see in online play, it gets harder because you can't crosstalk. Whereas at a table, people are chattering. There's noise. So what happens when you remove that? What happens when you just don't do a thing, when you sit in silence? And, you know, that's antithetical to the role-playing experience. It's a verbal medium. So, you know, it got me thinking, well, what would that look like? What would a game that encoded silence look like? So that happens to me all the time. I don't know that I have universal truisms about game design or axioms that I always follow. You can see through lines in my games. You can see things that are true for me quite often, and we can talk about those. One of them is that I really design first for myself. Maybe that's a universal truism. And after myself, my dearly beloved closest friends who I play with, try to play with every week. And if a game doesn't inspire me, they're never going to see it. And if they don't like it, you're never going to see it. So it kind of has to be something that collectively this really tight circle of people really loves before it goes any further. And we have very rigid constraints on how we interact. Like, we meet for exactly 2 hours once a week. And so if you look at my games, quite often they work very well in that block of time. And that's just the nature of my personal lived experience.
It's so cool to hear about like a beta group for game design. I know, Elliot, you kind of have that, and other game designers we talk to have had that, but I love the idea of like, things only get past you, they get to a small group, and that's the thing that like is the litmus test of whether or not it goes further. And the dynamics of those groups are always really interesting to me.
And you have to love them and trust them, and they have to be able to be like, no, back in the drawer, this one's no good. And because if they can't do that, or they don't have the skills to do that, then it's not useful. But if they do, then they're just precious, and I love them so much.
How often do you get the note of, no, back in the drawer?
pretty often. It's yeah, when you mentioned, like, I bet you have 100 games that you've not published. Well, it's a much bigger number than that.
yeah.
I really just want to call that out because that's so important to remember of, like, you know, we talked to Vinny Civiletti in a recent episode who his personal motto is make bad games.
Oh, yeah.
I think it's just so important to remember, like, yeah, not everything you can make is going to be the thing that goes out and becomes, you know, Fiasco or Night Witches or something. You got to just keep making and keep making and keep making.
Yeah, like make at different scales and with different intentions and collaborate and, you know, make tiny things and make ambitious things that you know you don't have the chops for yet and be willing to put stuff away. Like when my friends are like, no, this stinks. Sometimes it goes straight in the trash, but most of the time it just goes in a drawer to percolate. And I often tell the story of Night Witches, which is that I learned that history, got really excited about it and immediately wanted to make a game about it. I made a game and it was terrible. It was definitely one of those where my friends were like, this just doesn't. It doesn't work. It's a cool story, but no. And it took 7 years before I had the technology to do it. And it was really playing Apocalypse World where a light bulb went off and said, this is the technology that solves my Night Witches problems. So like I've got tons of stuff that's just sitting around on a hard drive waiting for me to learn how to do it. And that's a good place to be too, because I'm always growing. I'm getting better at what I do. And as I get better, I hope I learn new things or solve old problems.
7 years. I want to underline that for folks that, like, you know, Night Witches is this game that you're one of the games you're known for among many. But like 7 years is a journey for a game to take. And that, like, that sort of willingness to let something percolate, I think, is a good lesson to pull out for like aspiring game designers, is that, like, hey, just because you put it in the drawer doesn't mean it's never going to happen. I put a game in the drawer last year and I'm like, I have to remind myself that it's not gone. It's just doing that percolation thing while I learn the things I'm supposed to learn to go back and figure it out.
100%. And you might be stripping it for parts someday. That's happened to me too. My game Durance, it was a complete part strip from another game that didn't work. So like, but the technology in it is really good and I could repurpose it. But for its original purpose, it wasn't good. I was the wrong person at the wrong time to be making the game that it wanted to be. And so like, I just kind of put that aside and it got turned into something different. Yes, I think that that's a great lesson. Just be patient with it. When a game's ready, you'll know it. When a game is ready to tell you what it wants to be, if you're listening, you'll know it. Maybe there's my universal truism, is that I listen to the game. And that sounds real weird, but if you listen to what a game wants to be, it will tell you. And as you're making it, it's going to help you if you are making it into what it wants to be. And it will fight you if you don't. And that has been always true for me, for sure.
Oh, I love that. I really, really love that. It's funny because we've talked about a lot about like how TTRPGs and like role-playing games in general, it's like it's one half of a conversation where like you're starting a conversation and the player's finishing it. But there is, you're describing this other kind of thing of it where it's like before that conversation starts, this long, sometimes argumentative conversation happens between designer and game, which is, oh, I just really love that.
I do feel that way. I feel that that's true. And yeah, and like there's a lot of conversation around like the how much do we honor the intent of a game designer? Like once the game is at my table, it's mine, and I can do whatever I want with it. And my friends and I are going to shape it into something that might be different from what they want. And there's a school of thought that no, you should really respect the intent, and that the designer knows what they're doing, and that you should trust them. And there's a different school of thought that says that's a lot of garbage. And they both have, you know, they're both very reasonable points of view to take. But yeah, it's like there's a three-way conversation happening in my mind. Like, what am I trying to do? What are my friends trying to do? What was the person who wrote this game trying to get us to do? And I'm, as a designer, I'm acutely aware of that. And it's hard for me to read a text and not think about that.
There's a piece of advice I heard recently for artists that I think applies really well to game designers, because game design is an art form that is so much out of your hands once it leaves you. Like, if you make a music album and you and someone listens to it, they listen to it in one way. But the line was, I make what I want to make, and they eat it the way they want to eat it.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a good way to describe it.
It's a good way to recognize, like, yeah, once it's out of your hands, it's no longer yours. They're going to do whatever they want with it.
It's a tricky thing, because there are tricks you can play to get people to comply. People want rules, they want boundaries, and normally those boundaries are suggestions, but they don't have to be, which is super interesting. So in my game Cowboys with Big Hearts, there needs to be a turn-taking determination. You have to decide who goes first. And I say the most recent person who rode a horse plays first, which is like whatever, you know. It's an interesting thing to talk about with your group. It's evocative of the sort of Western setting, great. But then I say, if none of you have ridden a horse, you are forbidden from playing this game. Which, you know, like, obviously it's out of my control. I can't stop you. But I want there to be that moment of hesitation where you're like, well, can we?
Yeah.
And I think that that's a beautiful moment. And you can absolutely sort of flex those muscles as a game writer and designer to mess with people on that level, too.
I love a hostile game rule. That's so good.
I'm really just imagining, like, a kid getting this game, sitting down with their friends, and then being like, Mom, I got to ride a horse.
I hope that happens. That would be fantastic.
That's the platonic ideal, is the kid who rides a horse intentionally so that they can play the game.
That's true.
Yep.
That's equivalent to the Maurice Sendak, like, he loved it so much he ate it thing.
Yes, yes.
So there's a thing you mentioned a little bit ago, Jason, that I want to pull out of, like, make games of different scales. And I think that this is something that I find really interesting about your career, is that over a long career of making games as big as the Fiasco box set, you also continue to make and release small games. And I think that there's an impulse that I know I face as, like, kind of a new designer of, like, no, you go big, and then you go bigger, and then you go bigger, and then you go bigger. Like, there's this, like, kind of driving capitalistic force that's like, no, make the bigger, more ambitious game. How do you kind of maintain the artistic practice of, like, no, sometimes make the small thing and put it out and don't turn it into a product the way that, you know, Fiasco is, as an example?
Well, there are a bunch of competing factors there. We're a really small company. It's just the two of us and then a few contractors. So, like, we don't have the cycles. We don't have the resources to do really big, ambitious stuff all the time. I have the resources to make all kinds of ideas come to light. And I'm constantly iterating and creating new stuff. And some of that just, it doesn't have the legs to be a, you know, grand project. Some of it is just me practicing, staying, you know, staying current, exploring ideas. And some of it is limitations in our ability to execute. So a little of both. Also, remember what I said about games telling you what they want to be. Sometimes there's just the clearest thing in the world that a game is like, this is a 15-minute experience. I'm 15 minutes long. If you try to make me an hour long, I'm not going to work. If you try to make me a boxed set, then it doesn't make any sense for anybody. So, like, if it's a 15-minute experience, you know, I'm not putting it in a box. I'm not putting it on a store shelf. I'm going to give it to my patrons, or I'm going to make it something that you can get for free, because that's just kind of where it wants to live. So, yeah, I think just listening to what the game wants kind of will differentiate a lot. And then having the ability to execute at different scales can speak to that. So, like, we're in the process of doing this crowdfunding campaign for Jeunesse Wonder Tales. The game is done. It's feature complete. We're going back and forth with the pre-press guy, with our printer. Like, it's at that stage where it's very nitty-gritty technical stuff about how the box is constructed and whether it's going to have a UV finish and how the metallic ink layer works. Like, the really tedious, difficult stuff. But at the same time, I have, I don't know, 6 games in various states of development that I'm also working on and that I'm eager to get back to as soon as we're done with this conversation. I've got one open in another screen that I'm really excited about. And it's, you know, I'm going to bang it out. It's going to be done in a week and it's going to be a really small game. And then I'll show it to my friends. We'll try it. They'll tell me it sucks and I'll put it in a drawer or they won't. And something will happen with it.
All right. So listeners, this is going to be a slightly shorter episode because we need to get Jason back to work because we got another game.
Please don't make me. Don't make me go back. I don't want to go back.
I love that we just got to see in real time the conflict of like a writer and game designer of like, oh, I'm so excited. I really want to work on this. But as soon as we're like, get back to work, you're like, no, wait.
No, this is my break time.
I didn't mean it. Yeah, the fun part of that one is done. There's just a lot of writing to do that is not that fun.
I think since you mentioned Xenia's Wonder Tales, I figure let's dive into that a little bit. And then kind of keep stretching out on game design in general. Can you give us just the pitch for anyone who doesn't know, what is Xenia's Wonder Tales?
Yeah, so this is a game that I've been working on for a while now. That is it's a tabletop role-playing game that emulates Slavic and Baltic folklore and folk tales. So the tales themselves are a little weird. They're a little dark. They're not what you necessarily think of with like Grimm's fairy tales, but they're stories with fairies in them and monsters and magic. And the cool thing about them, from my point of view, is that each tale is tightly constrained in a way that allows you to sort of play it to a satisfying conclusion in about an hour. It'll always play out differently, but it will be evocative of the source material in really cool, satisfying ways. The game ships with 6 different tales, and they're all, I think they're really cool. People seem to like them. And those tales like the Bear Lovers and the Bird Rivals. One of them is called Night's Funeral, because nighttime has died, and we have to decide whether dawn or dusk is going to be the new night, or otherwise we won't have darkness anymore. So, like, you know, that particular tale is very abstract in a really fun way, and others are pretty down to earth in a really raw kind of adults only kind of way. So there's a wide tonal range and they play fast. It's card based. So when you play, you're actually sort of laying out a tableau of playing cards that are custom designed for the game. It's optimized for 4 players. You can play with more or less, but there are always 4 characters in a tale. So if you're playing the Bird Rivals, there's Clara, who's the village girl who's engaged to be married tomorrow to the local lord of the manor. There's the lord of the manor she's going to marry. There's her stepmother, Dorota, who cares about her and also is a little worried about this marriage. And then there's this dude named Andre who just showed up, who immediately falls in love with Clara and she with him in the way of fairy tales. And so you got this weird situation where these two people are madly in love, but the young lady is going to marry somebody else. And then there's beef between the lord of the manor and Andre, and Dorota knows what's going on, but she can't say. And then some of these people aren't what they seem. And it's very interesting and exciting. And you're making choices about how the tale progresses and the choices that these characters are making as you play. It's really big fun.
I'm a big fan of, you know, fairy tales around the world and like the ways that, like, you know, there's this idea sometimes, like in when you like grew up in the West, you have this idea of what a fairy tale is, but then you like you learn about fairy tales from all over and you get this really fascinating mix of things. Did this start with you with like the fairy tales? Did this start with like researching these fairy tales, or are these all based on fairy, like specific fairy tales, or is there some mix of like you put your own twist on them, put your own creation into them?
Yeah, this is all through my lens. So these do not map 1-to-1. And I think the origin of this, it's sort of, there were 2 threads. One was that I'd been reading a lot of Baltic and Slavic folklore, just because it's another thing, like game design doesn't have a curriculum. You know, there's anything is grist for the mill. And so anything you read, if you're a curious person, is going to become valuable at some point. So I read everything. And yeah, so I read a book called The Man Who Spoke Snakish, which is absolutely incredible. It's a great book. It's Estonian, and it's based on Estonian folklore. And in it, it has this really unique point of view that I haven't seen in many other places, where it's putting you in the context of a story that's clearly mythical in nature, but treating it very prosaically. So in the book, like, of course you can talk to snakes. It's just the way the world works. And you can visit the snakes where they live, and they can visit where you live, and that creates its own tensions and problems. And that got me thinking, and some of the sort of leitmotifs in Slavic folklore are similar. Like, people go in the woods and fuck bears. That's just a thing you do. So these were milling around in my mind. At the same time, I was really thinking about certain game mechanics and how they work, like moves in Apocalypse World. And what happens when you completely decouple moves from supporting game architecture? And what you end up with is Xenia's Wonder Tales, which is a game that is a series of extremely customized Apocalypse World-style moves for these folkloric characters that prompt story beats that are absolutely right for this particular folktale. And so if you do these moves and you trigger them and reveal the choices that they offer you, you can't help but tell a really satisfying folk story, which is super interesting. So it's sort of taking that powered by the apocalypse technology in a different direction, I think.
You're also bringing in this, like, these sort of pre-generated characters, which I think has been like an interesting design space that we've really fallen in love with in the last couple of years through games like Yzeba's Bed and Breakfast. And I think that one of the things that people sometimes bounce off of when they hear a concept like that of like, oh, this is like a predetermined character or a predetermined story, like, what am I putting into this game? Where, like, for Xenia's Wonder Tales, does the player put their own choice and role play, and like, where are they changing these stories and making them their own?
Yeah, it's a point of attack issue. And I think people are accustomed to a particular kind of agency and a particular point of attack in role playing, but it's not the only way to do it. So in these stories, the characters are always the same. You're always going to have a particular tale with the same four people that are interacting in it. But the outcome is always going to be somewhat different. And the choices you make along the way are going to be different because you're being prompted by these particular moves that your character and all the characters on the tableau have available to them. So every character has three that are unique to them. And then each set has four that are things that I think might happen or should happen. So, for example, in The Carp Princess, one of the tales, there's a card that is when you lash out in violence. And when you lash out in violence, when that happens in the game, someone's going to be like, hey, you just lashed out in violence. And then you're like, oh, yeah, I sure did. You flip the card and it gives you a set of choices to make. So, spoiler alert, The Carp Princess, if you lash out in violence, this is what the card says. When you lash out in violence, calamity follows. Choose one, ask the victim to also choose one. And then there are three options. This is, if you've played any Apocalypse World style game, this is straight up, right? Choose one, the person you're lashing out at chooses one. And your options are, someone is savagely injured and will not live long. Someone is maimed or disfigured. Someone is knocked about and loses important memories. Play out your choices. And so no matter what two choices you make at that point and who you assign those choices to, the story is going to go in really different directions. I'm giving you a framework, and that framework itself is tightly bound. You're going to tell a folk tale, but I don't tell you how it's going to end. I don't tell you if any of these characters are going to have a positive or negative outcome to what happens. And what happens is the game kind of leverages Epiphania in a way, in the way that some of my other games do, in that since we know how folk stories kind of go, we kind of know what to do. And it feels like magic when you get to that moment when somebody lashes out in violence. You're like, oh yeah, of course this is what's going to happen, right? It's time for that character to die. Or it's time for that character to forget that he already gave the magic dress to Olga. Because if he doesn't know that, then Olga can do this cool thing. And we're all like, oh, yeah, right. It feels perfect. But if you are tone deaf to that and make different choices, it works great as well and sometimes even better because then you get these surprising arcs that are really fun too.
Midnight Muscadines is a cozy, dark tabletop role-playing game where light and shadow intertwine in a fractured world. Players take on the roles of Marmiteers, brave adventurers who journey into the untamed wilderness to collect the elusive Midnight Muscadines, craft magical jams, and protect the fragile light of Nim. Through collaborative storytelling and resourceful gameplay, players weave tales of courage, community, and the pursuit of balance. Will you preserve the light, uncover the truths hidden in the shadows, or reshape the balance of the world forever? Midnight Muscadines is perfect for fans of Studio Ghibli and Sea of Stars, who seek to capture the magic of exploration and the heartfelt adventure in a world where small heroes make a big impact. Play Midnight Muscadines as a traditional GM'd game, GM-less, or even solo. Midnight Muscadines is crowdfunding now on BackerKit. Join the campaign at pandeongames.com/muscadines.
I'm Quinns of tabletop role-playing game review show Quinns Quest, and this is Play to Find Out. Play to Find Out is an actual play podcast that brings notorious old games from the 80s and 90s back to the table. Each season of Play to Find Out, I'm joined by Emily Johnson and Rob Morgan.
Good? Nervous?
Yeah.
You both looked at each other really concerned, like you think what's about to happen is going to be unpleasant. And frankly, I think that's rude.
And together, we explore the TTRPGs of ages gone by. Our goal? To separate the TTRPGs that deserve to be remembered from those that maybe don't.
Can I
don't know, Emily. It was the 80s. A lot of people were on cocaine. We blow the dust from decrepit systems to learn how they work.
Your 100 on the encounter table bursts out. Right, you've encountered a bug. Get ready. Don't laugh.
How does one get ready for a bug?
Don't laugh.
Encounter their unique quirks.
I do finger guns to cover up how I wince.
A weird thing happens as you do finger guns.
Oh, no.
And I'm hoping that the Quinns Quest community will join us in exploring these games too.
If you this up, cannot describe to you how much your adventure ends here.
Yeah, that's fair.
Because the best way to learn is to play to find out. Play to Find Out is available now on the Quinns Quest Patreon, but the first episode of each series streams for free on the Quinns Quest YouTube channel and wherever you get your podcasts. Anyway, you failed the Earth Tech roll, and you made jokes while I was doing my exposition, so you don't get to hear any more.
No. Come on.
I was shook.
I'm curious, to bring it back to stuff we were talking about at the beginning, this idea of listening to the game. Was there a point in the development of Xenia's where the game told you something surprising about what it wanted to be?
Let me think about that. So the format asserted itself right away. The original version of the game was tighter and didn't have any universal actions in it. What it told me, and really what playtesting told me, was that there were things that I could expect to happen or that I wanted to happen. And that if I didn't articulate those in a global way, that players would either make it up themselves or they would think that they couldn't do it. So like in The Bear Lovers, this is a really good example of this. In The Bear Lovers, the game begins with two of the characters pregnant, very pregnant, gravidly pregnant. And two of the four universal cards are when you give birth. So those universal cards don't have to be triggered. They don't have to be enabled in play. But when you see that, you're like, oh yeah, okay. At some point in this game, I'm having a baby. And that's cool. That's going to be an interesting moment. And so it primes you to think about kind of what I want to happen. And if you ignore that, great. The game will still work just fine. But if you don't ignore that, something cool is going to happen. And revealing those cards, triggering them, is fun because it's a surprise. Something interesting is going to happen. Something will change. And so it's a little of both. And that's something that sort of had to develop. And then the number of those cards fluctuated over time. But the idea that there needed to be something, some universality to it, was something that the game kind of told me as we playtested. The other thing is that it needed a narrative framework. It needed somebody to be telling you about the tale, which is where Zhenya came from. So now there's this sort of crypt keeper character who's like, ha-ha, this is a story about these doomed people that are going to make terrible decisions. I hope you enjoy it. Ha-ha. And she bookends the experience for you with her own special card.
I'm always curious about, especially with games that use like cards or something, I'm thinking like For the Queen or Fiasco or, you know, Zhenya's Wonder Tales. It's such an easier on-ramp for people who've never played role-playing games to just get into a game. Is that something that you are often considering when you're looking at a game? Like, is this a game that should be played by people who are very experienced with games, or is it more meant for someone who is new, and how can I help them get in?
So there's two questions there. The second question, which is about how I position games in terms of their audience, I really want my games to be accessible to as many people as possible. I want them to be approachable. And they don't always succeed at that. And I do have some games that I think are a little more intense than others, and that maybe are, especially some of my earlier games, that are probably harder, have a more difficult on-ramp if you just don't know anything about role-playing games. Because I came out of a design culture that just assumed you knew some stuff. And that's not great. And I've taken steps to correct that in my own practice over time. But there was certainly a time when it was just like, I'm making this weird little game for 100 people who I probably all know. And every one of them, you know, I've played with at a convention. And every one of them, they know what I mean when I say, frame a scene, set stakes, or whatever the terminology du jour was. And I think that's sloppy design, and you shouldn't do that. You shouldn't make those assumptions. I think it's okay to be like, warning, this is not a game for you if the following things are not your bag. I think that's perfectly okay. And one of those things could be, if you're brand new to role-playing, maybe don't start here. But that most people just take that as a challenge. So you might as well make your game in a way that is comprehensible to people who are new as well. The other question you had was kind of about cards or about format. Format is tough because a game will assert itself, and cards are so good. They are so good for tabletop role playing that I'm often drawn to them as a medium. But they're also so terrible for so many reasons. And I've received very strict instructions from my business partner, Steve Sagetti, no more cards. We can't make card games anymore, partially because of the world and what's happening in the world in terms of fulfillment and costs and things, and partially because they're much harder to merchandise. They're harder to get on a shelf in a store.
Oh, interesting. I'm actually surprised to hear that.
Well, the problem isn't that retailers don't want them or won't buy them. The problem is that they don't know what really to do with them when they get them. Because they have a role-playing game section that is like a library of binding, you know, spines on a few face-out books. And then they probably have a board game section which has card games in it. And they have a way to merchandise card games in one of those two sections, but not the other one. So like it's a weird product fit at the retail level. So like you can put it in a cool box like we did with Desperation, and that helps. But if you merchandise it or if you produce it like a card game, which is the logical format for a game on cards, then it's very awkward for a retailer. But that I think that's less of an issue than the one that reflects costs, shipping, production. It's very hard to get cards produced domestically in the United States, which means that typically you're doing them in China, and that's maybe not going to be viable soon. So yeah, lots to think about there. But I do love them, and I've made many games that use cards because they are not threatening. A big reason why we moved to that format for Fiasco was because we could not call it a role-playing game, and we could get card and board game people to look at it.
I know I had an experience maybe a year ago of being at a like dinner party with a bunch of friends who weren't role players. They were all like performers, but they'd never done D&D or any kind of role-playing game. And someone had the box set of Fiasco, and I, of course, I immediately recognized, and I was like, "No way, they have this here!" And they pulled it out, and they're like, "Hey, you guys want to try this?" And I hadn't played Fiasco out of the box; I'd only done the book, and I kind of just took a bit of a back seat and like watched it happen. I was like, oh, this is cool. Like, I hadn't seen the magic happen of people not know what role-playing is or not know what role-playing games are and then be brought into it by such a simple, familiar mechanic. Like, because they had a familiar, like, it looks like a deck of cards that they're used to. It looks like, you know, prompts that they're used to. And the second they had that on-ramp, within a scene and a half, people were doing whole role-play scenes going back and forth.
I love that. That's a great story. That makes me really happy.
It was really cool. It really, I think that was the moment where I was like, oh, format fucking matters. Like that can, and the idea of that on-ramp into a game is so like stuck into my head because of that experience.
And did you notice, I'm sure you did notice, that there's even a board in the box, right? There's a little play mat that kind of, again, it's just a way to be like, you know how to do this. You've done this before. All these pieces are familiar to you. There's nothing here to be alarmed about.
It is just a great reminder of like when you show someone a role-playing book, they're like, this isn't a game, it's a book. I'm like, no, but you played make-believe when you were a kid. You've done this before. We've just added a few rules to it.
Yep, that's very true. There's a sweet middle ground where you can create an object that's appealing so that someone wants to take it off the shelf and look at it, and then you kind of have them. If it doesn't look like a technical manual, maybe.
I know we were at, this is just a side, but we were at PAX, you selling games for Elliot. And anytime you could just get someone to hold a thing, it was like, oh, there's like 70% chance they're selling it. They're buying it. I'm just like, here, look at it. Pick it up. Take it out.
I'm interested in it kind of taking this a little bit back to like how you've built a career. You mentioned Steve, who is the co-owner of Bully Pulpit with you. How has that partnership and Bully Pulpit played into like, allowing you to form like a kind of sustainable career as a game designer?
Yeah, barely sustainable. I'm not a rich dude. I've made concessions to the fact that this is my calling, you know, as an artist, like any artist does, and that sucks. So there are really two threads here. One is that Steve and I are really good friends, and when we started the company, the first item on our agreement, on our LLC agreement, is that the rubric we'll use to decide what we're going to do is, will we stay friends if we do this? Which is a very naive way to approach doing business, right? It's a business. We're supposed to make money. Well, we don't make as much money as we could because of that first rule. There are things that other opportunities we turned down because one of us isn't comfortable with it for whatever reason. And if either of us isn't comfortable, then we're not doing it because we wouldn't stay friends if we did. If we reach a point where there's tension, then we talk about it and normalize based on our deep love for each other. So like, that's not a thing that every partnership has. It's probably not a thing that every partnership should have if they want to become fantastically successful. But if you want to have a fulfilling career, man, that's nice. It's really good. It's good to have someone in your corner, someone who is really talented in ways that you are not. Steve is awesome at many things that I've really struggled with. And so together we're like a Voltron of game publishing, I guess, because he's good at the stuff I'm not. I guess I'm good at stuff that he is less good at, although he has designed and won awards for games too. So that may not be true. But and really, like in a company like ours, the game design piece of it is the smallest piece. And I don't mean to minimize myself or poor mouth myself, but like I would probably be doing this even if I didn't get to share it with anybody, because it's like, it's art, right? I can't help it, and I've always done it my whole life. But to be able to be successful is really gratifying. And it's an important part of that is that I have that support network, not just Steve, but there's tons of people around me who are supportive and helpful and make sacrifices for my success.
I kind of want to talk a little bit more, just because we're on it, a little bit more about business. And I know a lot of people who are listening to this podcast are game designers who want to make careers out of it. And the reality of the business side of things is sometimes more opaque than the realities of like the creative side of things. Over your career and your partnership with Steve, what have been some of the biggest like learning lessons or you know, greatest learning lessons and like fumbles that you think other people could learn from you?
Mistakes that we have made. I don't know, like define a mistake, right? We've made choices. We have made choices that we have come to regret. We've made decisions based on our existing reality that if we had changed that reality somehow, things could have turned out better. We've been screwed over by people. Like that's not, there's nothing you can do about that. It's just part of life. So I don't know. I'm trying to think of something that we did where we were like, oh man, that was a bad call. It was a bad call. Like we invested a lot of money in that. And it didn't go anywhere. That rarely happens. We're very conservative about funding and money, maybe too conservative. We one of our other, like the second principle after stay friends is don't lose money. And we haven't. And part of that is by not taking risks. You know, we could have taken some really big shots that might have paid off and might have not paid off. And if they had not paid off, we would have lost money. And, you know, see point number two.
Honestly, those are some really good tenets of like how to form a successful business partnership of make sure you stay friends, don't lose money. Like they're simple and they're easy, but that's a big part of the equation there.
It is. And I think it's to a person with a business background, it's naive, right? Because it's not about friendship. It's about success. And you make money by spending money. You make money by taking risks. So like, we're not doing that stuff. And we're still a really small company.
But I think you've also changed your definition of what success is. Your definition of success is we're still friends. By that metric, 100% A plus all around.
Right. Absolutely. Yeah, that's true. And we've made more friends. Like we treat people fairly, right? We're an ethical company. We do what's right. So like we pay people pretty well and we treat them with respect, which again, like that's success. We managed to do that. That's success. A lot of people are awful to contractors or employees and don't pay them well, especially in this industry. And by not doing that, that's a metric of success for sure.
It is a big thing we've been working on as Many-Sided Media, as like a podcasting company, of making sure that the ambitions that we have and the new things that we want to do, that at every time, at every point along that curve, we're able to support the people we're working with and like able to do it fairly and able to do it well and beneficially to all. And if at any point we can't meet those standards, that's usually why we don't do that next thing. We're like, oh, we haven't done enough work to get us to a point that we are able to do this properly and well and fairly. And until then, we don't get to do that project. But once we figure it out, then we get to make it.
100%.
I guess on the other side of your work, you have, I think, supplemented game design by doing things like consulting and making game projects for institutions and organizations. And I'm a little curious about that side of our industry. It's one I'm not like super familiar with. What has that work looked like for you, and how has that kind of, you know, contributed again to this sort of career, this just sustainable career?
Just sustainable, yeah. Well, that helps a lot because institutions pay better than fans do. And you're a consultant coming in with deep expertise on something that they don't know anything about. And that can be really useful. So I came out of that work began mostly in academia. I worked for a university for a long time, which gave me some contacts. So I did some work within my university, within units within that, that led to other work. And then that led to, you know, other connections outside of academia. And also just being known as like the fiasco guy has been useful to me. So having a reputation, a broader reputation personally and as a company has been really beneficial as well. And I'll tell you, reputation is everything in both in the, like, the games, quote unquote, industry, but also if you want to be doing consulting kinds of work within the industry, like a bad name is forever. I don't know. I try to just be nice to people. And if I have something mean to say, I'll say it in the middle of the woods. I'm not going to badmouth people or be a jerk. There's just no percentage in that. You know, I have strong feelings about things, but I don't have to share them.
Yeah.
There's no need for that.
That's good advice. If you got something bad to say, go say it in the middle of the woods.
And I do, you know, sometimes I get mad and I need to vent, and I will not vent to Blue Sky. I will vent to a pine tree. And that's, I think that's smart. So anyway, people can look at me and be like, ah, he's a pretty okay guy. I like his work. I have a positive recommendation for someone who has worked with him. Let's give it a try. And that's how it's sort of started for me. And also having a network of people that do it, you know, you find other people within the game community who are working on projects and, you know, they're overclocked. They need somebody to help, or they need someone to, they have a client who needs another person to come on board. That recently happened to me. Another game designer who does this kind of stuff was like, I love these people, but I don't have the time to do this thing with them. Do you want to do it? And I said, yes, yes, I do. And so I got another gig, which is great. I don't know that there's a method to it other than think about your network, protect your reputation, be a cool person to work with and do good work and be available and want to do it. Probably a good way to start is to do it for people that you believe in that could really use it. So like go to your local, I don't know, your local protest movement and be like, hey, how would you guys like to have a gamified experience that trains you how to remove pepper spray from your eyes or whatever your thing is. And then when, you know, you have the opportunity to work with a company, you can be like, well, I've already done some of this work pro bono for these other organizations. And you look a little bit more credible.
And what is that when it comes to like the getting into the design for these projects, how does that differ from the other design work you do, or does it differ?
It does. It differs a lot. It depends on the client. So I have a client right now that said, we want you to come in and be a coach. We don't want you to actually make anything for us. We want to make it ourselves, but we want you to be there to be like, why don't you try this? That's a good idea. Good job, team. Terrible job, team. And that's a very different ask then we want you to come in and make a game for us about how to recover from a hip replacement surgery, which, you know, is that's a different kind of task than coaching a team or mentoring a group, and an easier one, to be honest, because with that one, I don't know anything about hip replacements, but there's a subject matter expert who does. And I know all kinds of stuff about games and they don't know anything about it, but the two of us in a room can make a, you know, can solve that problem. Whereas if I'm coaching a team, I have to be like, well, let me teach you how to make games. Let me teach you how to replace me, which is more complicated.
Sure. Let me teach you how to replace me. It's very funny.
But ultimately, it's a better solution for them, because then once they have those tools, they can make unlimited games on their own without me.
Is there a game you've made that, like, if you can talk about it, like, that in one of those kinds of collaborations that you, like, left and you were like, oh, I would take this to the home game for our 2 hours a week and play it?
Very rarely, because often they're so specific that they're about a very, very specific thing that just doesn't translate or that requires subject matter expertise to engage with. Right. So I'm working with one that's now it's for renewable energy experts in Africa. And if you're not a renewable energy expert in Africa, I just don't think it's going to be that cool. You know, it's
sure.
It's just not going to be that fun to play because you don't understand the nuances of the choices you're making or the realities on the ground or the cultural imperatives. You just won't get it. And to workshop that is too much for what the game is. That's often the case. Sometimes, but pretty rarely.
Yeah, sure.
Sometimes I'll force my friends to play test. And I'll just be like, this isn't going to be fun. You're going to hate
like,
it.
Oh no, it's energy expert week.
Sometimes there'll be games that I have to make a puzzle for. There's got to be some kind of goddamn puzzle in it. And then I have to take it to my friends and be like, can you figure this out? And then that's useful. It's a good use of their time for me.
That just made me think of kind of a broad question just about game design in general. When, like, because obviously, like, game designers have to do a lot of things. You have to, like, do technical writing, and you have to do mechanic design, and you have to do, like, prose writing and stuff. What is your sort of favorite and least favorite of the elements that go into the work you do on a game?
Yeah, you're right. Like, it's an interesting form of applied art because you are doing many, many things. Or have the opportunity to do many, many things. A lot of people know what they suck at and don't do that part. And I respect that. I really like the sort of, I don't know, the snuggly part of the process where it's just me and an idea, and I get to sort of wrestle with the idea until it reveals itself to me in a fun way, and I start to see what it wants to be. That's my very favorite part. Like, the thing that I'm going to be jumping back into when we're done here is it came because I learned that Angela Lansbury, the actress, has a daughter who got mixed up with Charles Manson in the late 60s. And she was like, enough of that. And she took her whole family and relocated to Ireland, just specifically to get her daughter away from Charles Manson. Maybe saved her life. Who knows? But I was like, well, that's interesting. That's a weird story. And so I've got a whole game that's just about Angela Lansbury saving her daughter from Charles Manson. And as you can imagine, it's very focused. It's a very very specific kind of experience. And that's the fun part for me, is going from, I just read a cool thing, to how I can make this into a real fun thing for other people to explore and learn about.
Man, I've been sick for the past 5 days, and I spent like 5 hours a few days ago watching old episodes of Murder, She Wrote, so I really want to check that out.
Yeah, yeah. Look it up. There's some contention about what actually happened, but she absolutely, her daughter absolutely was mixed up with Manson tangentially, and she absolutely pulled up stakes and left the country. So
it's like it's what you're saying before about everything is grist for the mill. I think that that's like another good lesson for games folks, is like, you know, just like absorb stuff, you know, read interesting things, and like, you never know when one thing is. Be curious. That's a good one. Be curious is a good thing to pull out.
Yep. And if you think about how that extends into daily life, like, everybody's interesting. Everybody has a story to tell. Anything you might read can be fascinating from a point of view. Hey, here's the book that I'm currently excited about. It's called Everything About Sewing, Ponchos, Capes, Scarves, and Stoles. It's a pamphlet from Vogue Patterns. It was published in 1971. Now, it's a design masterpiece. Like, the book is beautifully laid out. I'm absolutely stealing the layout for my next game. Probably the Angela Lansbury game, because the time kind of lines up.
Yeah.
And like, who would have thought, you know?
Who would have thought?
It's just, if you see these things and you're curious, whole vistas will open up for you.
If you'd given me 50 guesses about what you would have pulled out when you said what you're reading right now, it never would have been that.
But it's very good.
Really cool.
If you want to make a cape, it is an excellent guide.
So, Jason, this has been a really lovely conversation. I'm sure there's, you know, another hour of stuff that I'd love to ask you about, but we're coming to a close. And the question that we ask everyone that comes on the podcast is, what are you bringing to the table? And this is just our cute way of asking for a recommendation to our listeners. This recommendation can be anything. It could be a person, a game, a show, a resource. It can be in tabletop. It can be outside tabletop. It can be to go outside and look at the sun today. So, Jason Morningstar, what would you like to share with our audience today?
Oh, well, the game I'm playing, which seems relevant, we're playing a lovely game called Super Bandit, which is a TTRPG about playing space fighter pilots, doing space fighter pilot stuff and having space fighter pilot drama. Highly recommend it. It's an adorable, really short game. It's mostly just a series of tables and a pretty tight, interesting space combat system. Super Bandit!
Super Bandit.
Let's say it all once. 3, 2, 1.
Super Bandit!
That's it. That's it.
That's hell it. Yeah. Cut it, print it, sell it.
Cut, print, sell. Check the gate. We'll put that link in the show notes so you guys can check out Super Bandit yourself. Thank you so much, Jason, for coming to the table. Do you want to let people know where they can find you online if they're looking for you, and also where they can find Xenia's Wonder Tales?
Yeah, well, so I am at JM Star. I'm kind of active on Blue Sky. You might find me there. And Bully Public Games is my company, bullypublicgames.com. bpglink.com/Xenia's will get you to the crowdfunding campaign for Xenia's. I hope that you'll consider taking a look, and I know you'd love it if you do.
Yeah, and indeed, we didn't even get to talk about the beautiful art by Momatoes, which really sells the whole fairy tale aesthetic. I love Momatoes' work.
Thank you. That's another thing that we feel really strongly about, is that game art is often boring and looks the same. So we reach out to people who are going to make beautiful, very individualistic art for our projects. And Mamados did a great job. I love the art for Genyas.
And if you want more gaming content from us here at Talk of the Table, check out the Many-Sided newsletter or the Many-Sided Media Discord, where you can talk about this and all the conversations we have on Talk of the Table. You can support this show on Patreon at the Many-Sided Media Patreon, where you can get ad-free episodes, bonus roundtables, and a whole bunch of other fun bonus content for this and our other show, My First Dungeon. Please remember to rate, review, and follow Talk of the Table wherever you get your podcasts. And that's what the table is talking about. Bye-bye, everybody.
Bye-bye.
Bye.